Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have you for this hour so we can explore topics that can empower us, enlighten us, inform us. Today, we're going to continue with an in-depth look at who's behind the capturing of the internet, all of our personal data, surveilling on us, and then if we should do anything, say anything, share anything that counters the official narratives put out by the White House or corporate America, then we are considered no better than the domestic enemy. We are not. We are advocates. Historically, we have been right on every major issue. We said, don't go into Iraq. And they said, yes, we must, weapons of mass destruction. We said, don't go into Vietnam. They said, yes, the domino theory. We said, don't go into Syria or don't go into Libya and don't engage in regime change in Honduras or the Ukraine. But it didn't matter what we say. We said your food is poison and you're developing an entire generation addicted to certain tastes, salty and crunchy, sweet and soft, and diabetes in children, adult diabetes at an epidemic level. They didn't care. They said, we're real science. And your quackery. Those who've advocated for healthier, happier lives, coexistence, conciliation, forgiveness, cooperation, unity, we have been mocked and ridiculed as foolish, naive. And yet, go back and look at the efforts we've made compared to theirs. Theirs are divisive, and right now we are country divided, and that is harmful. We are country at war with each other. That is even worse. Throughout most of our careers, at least those of us who have spent decades in the trenches fighting these issues, we have always seen that the establishment was not on our side. People come into and out of movements, anywhere from several months to several years, but then they realize at some point they have a life to live and that they had their adventure and having their voice heard. And then they go back to their families, friends, education, and the next step in their journeys. But the journey for us does not stop. The battle doesn't stop because people come and they go. Right now we see many very divisive things being said. And yet what are we not paying attention to that is equally, or if not more important, our very survival? I'll give you a few examples. Yesterday was the hottest day ever recorded in part of California. It was 130 degrees. We had over 100 people die in Oregon in the last 2 weeks in a heat dome. That had never happened before. But people are dying throughout the world because of lack of water or too much water or changing environments they weren't prepared for. Right now, as we speak, more than 50 million Americans are victims of the drought. Some are farmers and will not be able to plant a crop this year and probably not in the near future. What happens then to their savings, their retirement, their future, their children's future? Harken back to the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Great Dust Bowls. Now we have the Great Sand Bowls, something we'd never had before, and which is very destructive. Plus the Great Dust Bowls are coming back. We have at least 100 million people in the world who are environmental immigrants. They're having to leave where they had lived because they can no longer sustain life in Central and South America, in Africa, in Indonesia. But who survives all of these calamities? The corporatist, the neoliberalist, the person promoting hegemony throughout the world, power. These are the people who are wanting to not eat meat anymore, but eat a genetically engineered veggie burger. Did you look at how it's made? Probably not, but Bill Gates wants you to eat that. But is it safe? They guarantee it's safe. The FDA says so. The USDA says so. How do you know? When you put a genetically engineered element into your body, it can become and will become your own DNA. And they know about jumping genes. A Nobel Prize was won on discovering that. Now they tell us that the vaccines are safe and effective, and I hope so because I'm pro-vaccine. I'm simply pro-proven safe and effective vaccines. These have not been proven. Remember the emergency authorization use? And now we're seeing the toll that is being taken. And we're going to play some victims' voices today, because you will not hear any of these people ever on the mainstream media, the corporate media. And that's unfortunate. Now, there have been times when the corporate media has been dominated by the conservative Republican right-wing establishment. Now it's the corporatized Democratic Party left-wing. It's really irrelevant to those who have power, because they control everybody in that circle, with few exceptions. So we try to politicize it, say this person's right-wing or left-wing, and therefore they're the problem. No, they're merely those people who've adapted to or succumbed to the pressures to self-censor or to look for someone else as being the enemy, triangulating guilt and shame. And as a result, we, the people, are paying attention to whoever has our ear, and therefore we can be conditioned to believe in a lie and take it forward instead of looking independently for the truth. And how many people are interested in finding the truth? What if the truth would hearken against your preconceived or conditioned notions? Would you accept it? When was the last time someone sought to debate because they chose to be better informed than prior to the debate? Are they even open to that? I have not seen such a debate. People are there to try to win their points, showing the other person wrong. Therefore, the other has less value. It's not to be taken seriously. It's to be ridiculed, scorned, and canceled. Recently, I did an article along with Richard Gale on the cancel culture. And the cancel culture has a lot of people advocating at this moment for a particular way of teaching in schools. I recently watched a lecture by Dr. Jonathan Haidt, one of the wisest professors I have seen. And he does not take a political position, and he said he is afraid to teach the way he did just a few years ago. He's afraid to play a video in his class, no matter how innocuous and innocent. He's afraid to touch on any subject that would in any way cause a microaggression feeling where someone would feel, because you said a word, that their whole life now is threatened, their existence is challenged. That is the kind of hypersensitivity that pervades some classes, not all, by some people, not all. The vast majority of America's youth, and they're between the ages of 0 and 18, the tens of millions, they're just trying to live a life. They're trying to find the meaning and purpose of their life. They're going through the stages of development of challenge, and they will take different views at different points depending upon where they're at in their journey. And who's there to guide them? It should be their parents. It should be their community. It should be the standards by which people live and historically live with a sense of purpose and meaning. But not all messages given by families or communities or villages or groups or religions are open to honoring the sacredness of other people and their values and views. Hence, we have this conflict, and it is a difficult challenge to overcome. We do not benefit by condemning everyone who holds a view different than our own. But we must be open to have a difference of opinion and still be respectful to each other. Because the heart of science, of which I've been immersed my entire life as a senior research fellow, is open debate. There are few certainties. But that is also true in journalism. Don't decide to write something based upon a preconceived notion. Let the facts guide you, and independently determine facts, not corporatized facts, not official science facts, because we've seen how often they have been wrong. And that's not me saying that. That's Dr. Angel, 22-year senior editor or editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and dozens of other people within the field. We're now seeing just how utterly corrupt corporate science is. And yet, try to get that message out in corporate media. Try to get out anything that challenges the existing point of view, and you'll hit a roadblock. So today I'm not doing health and nutrition at the beginning of our program. Instead, I'm setting this program aside for deeper thinking. You're going to hear Whitney Webb. You will not see her work in any mainstream publication, but she's quite simply one of America's most formidable investigative journalists. She is in a conversation with another outstanding journalist, James Corbett of Corbett Report, and they're talking about her research on who's behind the scenes, who is controlling the narrative, who is in control of Facebook and Google and Twitter and what they're allowing and disallowing and the connections they have, because these are the real deep state characters. Then before that, we're going to hear from Dr. Charles Hoff, H-O-F-F-E. He is a board-certified physician, and he risks his career, a completely normal medical career, over 30 years in practice, and he works with the indigenous tribes in Canada. He saw a problem with the COVID vaccine, and after seeing many of his patients have the same problem, including excessive miscarriages in pregnant individuals, he then began to look deeper, and he found some things about the vaccine that are troubling. Now, you can agree or disagree with part in part or whole to anything he is saying, but before you do that, he is telling you something that no one else has. And remember, we were the first person in the United States, right here on this radio program, to tell you about alternative treatments from Orthodox Medicine's medicine cabinet, over 19 different FDA-approved drugs, including ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which were immediately attacked and yet have now been shown to be completely beneficial and would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives in the United States and millions of lives worldwide had they been used. But Anthony Fauci and the pharmaceutical company did not want to compete with something that cost 10 cents when they can give you a drug at $3,000, something that's been proven versus something completely unproven. And so people were misguided. How to build up your own immune system with peer-reviewed literature out of PubMed. We did four articles on that, but also showing you the lack of honest science in the PCR test and the mortality counts. So look carefully at everything the Orthodox community has told you and look at what we've told you. And we put our information up to be shared. So you're going to hear those two, plus you're going to hear from real victims. And by the way, how many victims are out there right now when we're told that this is a safe and effective vaccine? Just take a guess. All right? How many people are learning the truth? I'll give you a few examples, and then you can look at the rest for yourself, because we try to post all of this information. For example, right now, by the way, next Tuesday night, we're going to play you a really mind-twisting show where Dr. David Martin is being grilled by Dr. Reiner Fulmich, who heads the new Nuremberg Tribunal. He's interviewed hundreds of the world's leading scientists about issues on COVID. And this time, he's asking Dr. Martin a simple question. Is there any evidence that people knew about the COVID virus prior to its discovery in some sick people in Wuhan? And he gives you the most accurate documented citations from the actual patents of Anthony Fauci and the CDC and all these other players, over 100 patents going clear back to 2003 and gain-of-function research, and shows you why you cannot patent something that's natural. Therefore, you couldn't patent the COVID vaccine, COVID virus, if it came from nature. It would be against the law. He also reads specific rejections of Anthony Fauci's personal application of why his virus vaccine would not work, and that was way back. So we have research going back, and that'll be a whole hour next week on the Progressive Commentary Hour, things you will not hear about anywhere else. But as of today, in the United States, 9,048 deaths, 26,818 hospitalizations, and how many are really serious, life-threatening? 56,970 under urgent care. How many people have gone to their doctor because of this? 80,269. How many suffer from Bell's palsy? 2,484. But 3,324 heart attacks, 2,200 myocarditis and pericarditis. How many disabled someone, and they may stay disabled the rest of their life? 7,463. and how many have life-threatening conditions as of now because they took the virus and lived, 7,823. That's just in the United States, and that's probably at least 9 times that actual amount. So you're looking at over 70,000 deaths, if you were to be honest, and not just 400 to 500,000, but probably around 5 million adverse reactions. So are you telling me New York Times, Washington Post, the Daily Beast, and all the other corporate entities that you don't find those numbers startling, or at least to stop and examine them, to talk with the people to see what conditions they've had? Or do you just think that that's completely okay and just keep going ahead? So we believe that we should stop and engage in an honest discussion of the precautionary principle. That means do not use the American public as human guinea pigs. In October of 1989, I wrote an article about human testing. I specifically stated that African Americans in the United States and in prisons and in the armed forces were used as human guinea pigs. That's institutional racism. Recently, people look back at why many African Americans, which is the largest group that is refusing vaccines, and as a percentage, and they use the Tuskegee experiment. That is correct. But now come forward. What about right now? The CDC has knowingly covered up information of a 324% increase in autism spectrum disorder in young males 36 months and younger. Is that not systemic racism? How do we know? Because we have it on record, and I've played him on this show, Dr. William Thompson, testifying to us that it was a cover-up. They couldn't allow, Big Pharma wouldn't allow, and the CDC wouldn't allow, because they're making their money off vaccines, allow this information to get out. So they were willing to sacrifice young African Americans, about 300,000 is the best guesstimate from Dr. Brian Hooker, to autism, so nobody stopped making money. That's now. That's not yesterday. That's not Tuskegee. So that shows you that an entire institution is systemically racist. Yet when was it criticized anywhere in the media by any group? It shows you the problems that we're facing. So we're here to try to sort this out, to make sense of it. And I'm going to begin today because recently I presented an article and I got a call and someone says, that's not specific. Who are you talking about? I want to be very clear who we're talking about. First off, people who are enraged by any social injustice should protest it. Go to the streets, as long as it's nonviolent. I do not support violence. I do not support anything that can threaten a person's life. I do support and always have nonviolent protest. And that's why when the big protest started last year, I fully supported it and went public with that, because it was raising awareness. I believe, however, that the problem is far deeper, as many of you do, than a police officer, dozens of police officers killing over the last several years, hundreds of unarmed people, when they could have used other tactics that were non-lethal and non-violent. But I've said, and you've heard me say, we should completely change the entire judicial system. I'm against all prison labor. If you're going to have someone in prison do your work, including firefighting, pay them a minimum wage per hour, not slave labor, because corporate America is profiting off people in prison being paid nothing, just a dollar or two, instead of giving them something that is an incentive and will help them. Secondly, I'm against private prison systems. I'm also against debt collection. I'm against not forgiving student debt. I believe we should forgive all student debt. I believe we should have no predatory interest on anyone and therefore have a way that through normal bankruptcy that people can get their debts forgiven, start over. I'm against all home foreclosures. I've told you many times that President Obama could have put a moratorium on home foreclosures. He didn't. He bailed out the banks and corporate America, not the average person or small businesses. I'm against the type of mandatory sentencing we have. I'm against anyone who has not committed a violent crime for being imprisoned. I believe that we should have a capacity for a person to have their life not forever damaged by prison record, but instead go back into the communities and work in community service within the community, they're helping that community in the process hopefully rebalance some of their perceptions on why they committed whatever crime they did. I believe all drug offenses should be ended, and everyone who's been convicted of a drug crime, unless it's something violent like murder, should be expunged so they can return to life. I believe we should have clinics to help people for free at the psychological level, as well as overcoming addiction. I know it works because I was the head of drug addiction at Trafalgar Hospital for many years, helped a lot of people. Punishment is not the answer. Rehabilitation is. But you first have to not see this as a crime. I believe we shouldn't have any war on drugs. And look at the war on terrorism. It has evolved into a massive, massive surveillance state. Now the Democratic National Committee wants the right to censor your emails. How close to fascism do we have to get before someone finally opens their eyes? But there's one person in particular who I've said on the air, and I will say it again, I believe represents an extreme danger to our current status and is preventing us from being able to heal, work together. After global warming, we're doing nothing. Absolutely nothing. We're increasing our carbon footprint, increasing industrialization, increasing expanding and building and private jets and eating meat. Everything you could possibly do to cause the problem, we're doing it. We're not reversing any of it. China isn't. India isn't. Brazil isn't. The United States isn't. There are three of the four biggest polluters in the world. So how exactly are we to stop what is going to become the new norm? Massive forest fires, massive drought affecting at least 19 states in the United States. I'm not even talking about worldwide, also major problems. So we say we're for something and we don't do anything personally to change it. It's time that we began to change. We began to get the money out of politics and the corruption out of politics. We have to begin to have Citizens Council instead of the Council on Foreign Relations Trilateral Commission telling us what to believe. We have to have people of the average nature, meaning just regular people, who decide the future they want and be in control of it instead of corporatized individuals coming from Washington and their think tanks and that large corporate-related group that control everything in our lives, especially the media. I want to share something today that puts everything into a little different perspective. Hopefully you'll appreciate it. I'm titled this The Misanthropic Rants of a White Fragilist. The fury over racism that has been raging across the nation following the criminal, unnecessary deaths of African-American citizens by police and deranged white supremacists is now becoming embedded in corporate boardrooms, legislative assemblies, school and university policymaking, and the left and right media. To an outside observer, it may appear that it is reaching a peak of many diverse, disjointed voices, sometimes seemingly incoherent, speaking against and past each other. When issues of race become so polarized within a politicalized social context, the entire message for raising anti-racist awareness becomes lost, unfortunately, too often in the static. But that doesn't happen to be the place we find ourselves in now. It's a little worse. Fortunately, many progressive anti-racial organizations and local movements such as Black Lives Matter, Color of Change, Live Free USA, Resources, Resource Generation, Rainbow Coalition, Equal Justice Initiative, among others, have managed to keep themselves above the cacophony of institutional noise. In the past, we have always supported public demonstrations against social injustices in all of its forms and manifestations. The average American has neither joined in protest at any level, not in the streets and not in the letters, but that with that mass majority of all colors, all races, all cultures, all ages, all educational and economic groups, your future depends upon what you do now instead of allowing those who are agents of corporate profiteering and control over your lives to dominate. Therefore, I support all students who are not looking to condemn another person based upon an artificial standard of division, but rather look to what they can do to challenge those in power, institutional power, from continuing their monopolization of all things, including G5. They've told you only the good things about it. They haven't told you the bad. Go to GaryNall.com and download all the articles, 13 articles we've written about G5 and its dangers. Those are real. What they're promising is a new internet euphoria. Get something so fast. Why couldn't they just put it in cables underneath the ground where there's no danger? That's not their agenda. Over the years, in our efforts to share unbiased criticism and constructive solutions in the controversies and debates over racism and social and economic inequality, we have recently singled out Robin DiAngelo and her writings and her bestseller, White Fragility. We have done so because we find that the deeper underpinnings of her message are fundamentally flawed and put forth an elitist position that theoretically silences any constructive debate about race, even if held on neutral grounds. David Burke describes in his book that her theory is, quote, snake oil masquerading as insight. Moreover, White Fragility is intellectually fragile, impoverished by a lack of convincing facts to buttress her premises, and in some cases mangling facts altogether in order to convince whites of their guilt-ridden birthright. For example, her claim that Congress is 90% white hasn't been true for several decades. Facts don't matter. But they do. Then we find some twisted logic such as, quote, her words, quote, I believe that white progressives cause the most daily damage to people of color. I define a white progressive as any white person who thinks he or she is not racist or is less racist, end quote. White Fragility is largely based upon the controversial theory of implicit bias that attempts to explain racism as a deep-seated systemic problem. Implicit bias is defined as unconscious favoritism towards or prejudice against people of a particular race, gender, etc. It is understood as being based upon unconscious associations and feelings. Despite DiAngelo's basing her premise upon implicit bias as something hardwired, meaning we're genetically born with it, we can't change it, we are victims of it, as if it were programmed into the brain at birth, she notes, quote, we simply do not understand how implicit bias works, end quote. This is perhaps one of her very few correct observations. A growing number of psychologists, behavioralists, are showing empirically that in practice the implicit association test, the IAT, is horribly inaccurate. The theory fails to predict behavior. Implicit bias training, which DiAngelo regularly offers to educational institutions and corporations, has been largely unsuccessful. In his book, Reinventing Racism, Why White Fragility is the Wrong Way to Think About Racial Inequality, economist and philosopher Jonathan Church has analyzed the deep flaws in implicit bias theory in great depth. Together, this raises a further question as to whether implicit bias actually exists as any kind of absolute condition. Since DiAngelo believes that all whites, no exceptions, all whites on the planet and throughout all of history, own unhealthy racial perceptions towards people of color, and therefore they are in principle irredeemable, she is implying that implicit racial bias is genetically inherited. Consequently, DiAngelo is preaching a form of cloaked scientific determinism that could have enormous detrimental repercussions in the future if it were to become a standard course in our schools' menus. In effect, similar to the doctrine of scientific materialism espoused by the larger community of neuroscientists, evolutionary biologists, modern skeptics, and the new atheists, she is advancing misanthropic dogma against the entire human race. This is secular religion at its very worst. However, not dissimilar to the delusional metaphysical realism held by cognitive scientists who believe the mind and consciousness are only the products of a neural pharynx and dendrites, white fragility's critical foundation is not even a conceivable scientific theory. It is bereft with sound empirical evidence. It is frankly illogical. And because D'Angelo has written a national bestseller, the university, school system, and media have swallowed it whole. Perhaps because D'Angelo holds a PhD, she can write gibberish, and therefore it is fine and permissible. Here, white fragility's gibberish is simply something untestable. All you need is a dash of blind faith, spiced up with very low self-esteem, and a propensity towards acute episodes of identity anxiety, and a person can believe in the existence of anything. If D'Angelo were to substitute white in her book's title for any other racial or ethnic group, it is difficult to imagine a university would keep her employed. It would be perceived as blatant racism. It would elicit a collective outrage, and no doubt she would be unanimously canceled. Hopefully, the white fragility craze is running out of steam. Whatever hint of intelligent rigor that may be found in D'Angelo's book is being quickly observed as a hoax, a sleight of hand. Her recently published follow-up book, Nice Racism, is a further excursion into a theater of the absurd. It has been bombarded with terrible reviews on Amazon. Matt Taibbi describes his anguished experience to read Nice Racism as being, quote, strapped to an ice floe in a vast ocean while someone applies a metronome hammer strikes to the same spot on your temporal bone over and over, end quote. Our position on racism is that there is absolutely no evidence that it is biologically ordained. It's not in your genes. We are living in a time when our society is ethically and spiritually bankrupt. In such a decayed social environment, the popularity of fanatical extremist views is expected. However, we mustn't undermine the elasticity behind our rational conceptions, biases and prejudices, and attractions and fears, thereby making them susceptible to radical change. There is nothing other than mental and emotional afflictions within everyone's means to subdue and even to eradicate. Are there cases of individuals who display the ability to transcend racial differences and views others equally and indiscriminately with the clarity of untainted loving kindness and compassion and equanimity? One immediate example is Garson Rinpoche, the subject of an inspiring new documentary called For the Benefit of All Beings, about a highly accomplished Tibetan yogi's life before and after serving 20 years in a Chinese prison and labor camps in Tibet. Garson Rinpoche shares his torturous experiences at the hands of his Chinese guards and how this gave birth to a deep compassion for the suffering and delusions of all peoples, including his captors. Today, he is widely recognized across the world, even within many Chinese communities, as a living embodiment of compassion and kindness, an example of our human capacity to transcend racial and ethnic differences. Examples like Garson Rinpoche and many others of some of the world's greatest peacekeepers convince us that anyone of sound mind is capable of achieving an awareness far above unconscious biases or epigenetically inferred biases. However, it requires a deep commitment to investigate the nature of our thoughts, feelings, and memories without consciously identifying or cognitively fusing with them. We mustn't expect government or even educational institutions on their own to undertake proper ethical actions to reduce racial strife and discrimination. Laws, yes, but a law in and of itself does not mean that a person is no longer going to do something or think something that's racially divisive. It merely means the law helps protect those that would be victims of it. Instead, what we need is for individuals and collective participation in this effort. There isn't a U.S. Department of Ethics and Kindness in Washington to guide policies to lessen racism in the nation. If there were, the department would certainly be susceptible to being captured and perverted by Congress's corporate masters for some kind of politicized social gain. In conclusion, racism must be confronted individually at a deeper spiritual level, and through that, a deeper introspection, if there is to be any hope for gradually succeeding in lessening racism altogether. We need each discover for ourselves that racial biases in and of themselves are based upon prior causal conditions and conditioning. They are not hardwired into the psyche's unconscious, as D'Angelo and implicit bias theory suggest, or genetically determined. I believe otherwise is a conceptual apparition, but nevertheless a ghostly specter that can be easily uprooted and purged if we can make an effort to observe directly our own thoughts, emotions, and afflictions. That can begin by acting contrary to what D'Angelo suggests. Cease reifying our baseless and biased assumptions onto others in the world around us. It has been our failure to undertake this personal challenge in the privacy of our own mind that continues to erode civility and is turning the nation into a spiritually barren wasteland. But there are still millions of people, if not tens of millions of people in the United States and billions worldwide, who do not look at you based upon any artificial condition, not based upon your ethnicity, your culture, your educational level, your social position, your age, your sexual identity. They're looking at you as a sacred human being. And if you look at someone as not the other to be disdained or attacked, ridiculed or mocked, or in some way shot or hurt, imprisoned, but instead as a sacred human being, and therefore feel blessed and honored to be able to learn from other cultures, to share in multiculturalism, where the best of every culture becomes something that we imbue our daily lives with, then we will not be fighting each other. We will not be into a whole new paradigm for a whole generation, complicit in the destruction of the other. Everyone becomes self-righteous and justifies their anger, their intemperance, when they feel they're right. And then look back and say, how many times were we wrong? I believe that we must take a spiritual road. Love one another. Respect one another. Work together. Otherwise, somewhere in this vast, unsettled universe of corporatism, elitism, the billionaires' club, you will see people smiling at the conflicts that we are engaged in, all the while they profit and manipulate. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going directly over to hear a doctor who is giving us information, specific information. Now, he would not give us this information if he had not done his research. So he is giving us a point to where we can start our own investigations, our own determinist efforts to see, is he correct or incorrect, in part or whole? Because if he is correct in what he's saying, then we have just unleashed an unimaginable horror upon the world. If he's wrong, we'll say he is wrong. But right now, we should pay attention to what he's saying. Back in a moment with him.
When the COVID vaccine is injected into your arm, we now know that only 25% of it actually stays in your arm. And the other 75% is literally collected by your lymphatic system and fed into your circulation. So these little packages of messenger RNA, and by the way, in a single dose of a Moderna vaccine, there are 40 trillion messenger RNA molecules, 40 trillion that are injected into your arm. So 3/4 of these are taken, connected by the lymphatics. They go into your bloodstream in these little packages that are designed to be absorbed into a cell. But obviously, when something's in your circulation, the only cells that they're going to get absorbed into is the cells around your blood vessels. And the place where absorption happens is in the capillary networks. In other words, these are the tiniest vessels where the blood slows right down. These are tiny, tiny vessels. So these little packages of genes are absorbed into the cells around the blood vessels. That's the vascular endothelium. The packages open, the genes are released. Your body then gets to work reading these genes and manufacturing trillions and trillions of COVID spike proteins. Because even though you get 40 trillion genes, each gene can produce many, many COVID spike proteins. So, and the purpose of the spike proteins is that your body recognizes this as a foreign protein and will make antibodies against it so that you're then protected against COVID. That's the idea. But here's where the problem comes. In a virus, in a coronavirus, that spike protein becomes part of the viral capsule. In other words, around it's part of like the cell wall around the virus called the viral capsule. But it's not in a virus, it's in your cells. So it therefore becomes part of the cell wall of your vascular endothelium, which means that these cells that line your blood vessels, which are supposed to be smooth so that your blood flows smoothly, now have these little spiky bits sticking out. So it is absolutely inevitable that blood clots will form because your blood platelets circulate around in your vessels. And the purpose of blood platelets is to detect a damaged vessel and block that vessel to stop bleeding. So when the platelet comes through the capillary, it suddenly hits all these little COVID spikes that are jutting into the inside of the vessel. It is absolutely inevitable that a blood clot will form to block that vessel. Now that's how platelets work. So just as this is absolutely predicted to cause cancer because it's full of carcinogens, these spike proteins will predictably cause blood clots because of where they're in your blood vessels. It is guaranteed. So Dr. Bogdi then said to me, the way to prove this is we need to do a blood test called a D-dimer test to find out if this is really happening. So, because the problem with the blood clots that we hear about through the media that they claim are very rare are the big blood clots. These are the ones that cause strokes and heart attack clots in your brain. Those are the ones that show up on CT scans and CT angiograms and MRIs. The clots I'm talking about are microscopic. These are tiny, they're literally on a capillary level and they are scattered throughout your capillary network. So they are not going to show on any scan, they're just too small and too scattered. So the only way to find out for sure if this predictable mechanism of clotting was actually happening was to do this blood test called a D-dimer. And so the D-dimer is a blood test that shows a recent blood clot. It doesn't show anything else other than a recent blood clot. It won't show an old blood clot. It only shows new blood clots. And so I have been now doing that on my patients, finding people who have recently had their COVID shot within the previous 7 days. It needs to be between 4 and 7 days, and doing a blood test on them called a D-dimer. And so I'm still trying to accumulate more information, but on the ones I have so far, 62% of them have evidence of clotting, which means that these blood clots are not rare. It means that the majority of people are getting blood clots that they have no idea that they're even having. So, Laura Lynn, the most alarming thing about this is that there are some parts of your body, like your heart and your brain and your spinal cord and your lungs, which cannot regenerate. When those tissues are damaged by blocked vessels, they are permanently damaged. So I now have six people in my medical practice with what we call reduced effort tolerance, which means that they just get out of breath much more easily than they used to. I have one fellow that used to walk to my office every week for an arthritis injection, who told me that he could walk 2 miles without any problem. And now after a quarter of a mile, he is absolutely out of breath. And it has been like that for 5 months. So on the basis of this D-dimer test, which proves that the majority of people are clotting, these six people who now have reduced effort tolerance, literally what's happened to them is they've plugged up thousands of tiny capillaries in their lungs. And the terrifying thing about this is not just that these people are now short of breath and can't do what they used to be able to do, but once you block off a significant number of blood vessels through your lungs, your heart is now pumping against a much greater resistance to try and get the blood through your lungs. And the problem, so that causes a condition called pulmonary artery hypertension. It's literally like blood pressure, high blood pressure in your lungs because the blood can't get through because so many of the vessels are blocked. And the terrifying thing of this is that people with pulmonary artery hypertension usually die of right-sided heart failure within 3 years. So the huge concern about this mechanism of injury is that these shots are causing permanent damage. And we haven't, you know, and the worst is yet to come because, you know, there are some tissues in your body like intestine and liver and kidneys that can regenerate to quite a good degree. But brain and spinal cord and heart muscle and lungs do not. When they're damaged, it's permanent. Like all these young people who are now getting myocarditis from these shots. They have permanently damaged hearts. It doesn't matter how mild it is, they will not be able to do what they used to be able to do because heart muscle does not regenerate. So this is the terrifying concern. And not only is the long-term outlook very grim, but with each successive shot, the damage will add and add and add. It's going to be cumulative because you're progressively getting more and more damaged capillaries.
Okay, this is the latest, 17,503 deaths. This is in Europe, 1,687,527 injuries in their database from the COVID vaccines. And when you start looking at all the specific breakdowns, which I do, you're looking at heart problems, 14,858, and with 1,165 thus far dying. That's just one. It's affecting people at the cognitive level, the endocrine level, every system of the body. Now, their figures are more accurate than those of the United States virus section, but you put the two together, you're already closing in on 30,000 deaths. Since when does 30,000 deaths and over 2 million injuries, some for lifetime, not mean something? And yet when people go back to their doctor, and we hear this over and over again, doctors, it couldn't be done. We're going to play you a little clip right now from some of those unheard voices because we believe that we should be, in this medium, a voice for the voiceless. Here are the voiceless speaking their truth. Name me one of these people, one of the million, right now it's 2 million people injured, who have had a voice on television. Name one of the nearly 30,000 dead whose family members have appeared to talk about their death, not one in any of the media. That shows you how captured and biased the media is. That's what needs to change also.
I'm about to have you meet and put faces to many of the real people who have been suffering after taking the COVID vaccine. We desperately need the medical community to recognize us and help us find a solution. Until this is recognized as a real problem, the medical community won't research this, and we will continue to suffer in silence without treatment. We're not anti-vax. On the contrary, we all tried to do our part to help stop the pandemic by getting this vaccine. So let me introduce many of them to you, all of them weeks to months out from the vaccine, and still being affected by these symptoms.
Johnson & Johnson, New Jersey. I want to be heard.
Pfizer, Ohio, we need to be heard.
Johnson & Johnson, Tennessee.
Pfizer, Illinois.
Moderna, Texas.
I live in Puyallup, Washington. I am suffering, and I want to be heard.
Pfizer, Florida, I want to be heard.
We need to be heard.
Please, let us be heard.
I had the Moderna vaccine in Wisconsin.
Pfizer, Indiana.
Pfizer, Florida.
I want to be heard.
Moderna. Minneapolis.
Moderna, New York. I need to be heard.
Pfizer, Louisiana.
Pfizer, Illinois.
I need help. I want help, and I want to be heard.
Pfizer, Maryland.
Pfizer trial for 12 to 15-year-olds, Ohio.
We need help.
We need to be heard.
Johnson & Johnson, California. Please, we desperately need to be heard.
I need help. And I need to be heard.
We need to be heard.
Moderna, Kansas.
Moderna, Virginia.
I received the Moderna vaccine on March 11th, and my life hasn't been the same since.
Pfizer, Texas.
Pfizer, Virginia.
Moderna, Oregon. I want to be heard.
Hear us.
I am now suffering, and I want to be heard.
We need to be heard.
Pfizer, California.
Michigan, Moderna. We need to be heard.
AstraZeneca, clinical trial in the United States. Utah, please, we need help.
I need to be heard.
Pfizer, Arizona.
Moderna, California.
Moderna, New Jersey.
I deserve to be seen, heard, and believed.
Please, we need to be heard.
Please, let us be heard.
Please, people need to know what we're going through so we can get the help we need.
My wife deserved to be seen, heard, and believed.
We have a right to be heard.
Please, there's so many of us that need help.
Pfizer, Berea, California.
Moderna, Connecticut.
Arizona, Johnson & Johnson.
Moderna, New Hampshire. We want to be heard.
I want to be heard.
We listened, so we believed that this vaccine was the right thing to do. So please, trust us and listen to us when we tell you that we are continuing to suffer physically.
I'm speaking on behalf of my 17-year-old daughter. Pfizer, New York. We need help. We need to be heard.
I am afraid to be shown due to the negative consequences some of my fellow sufferers have faced for speaking out. But I need help, and we desperately need the medical community to hear us.
I had the Pfizer vaccine, and I have been suffering now for almost 3 months.
Okay, those are just a few of the voices. How many voices? Over 2 million voices are not being heard. The medical community in rank has denied all responsibility. Anthony Fauci, no responsibility. The CDC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, no responsibility. The White House, no responsibility. Congress, no responsibility. The Surgeon General, no responsibility. Who in the world cares about 2 million suffering people? Many have lost family members, up to 30,000 dead. And yet, they were all identified, the companies, the individuals involved in this. None of these people have been identified. And unlike the former vaccines given, if you had a problem, you could go to the Justice Department and bring your action within a very short window of time to the Justice Department. Here, you cannot. Now, you've heard of absurd amounts of money being spent on people having any illness. A friend of mine had a stomach ache, went to an emergency room, he got an ice pack on his stomach. They gave him a simple, you know, dollar bag of saline, salt solution. That was it. $10,000. A snake bite, $150,000. A person suffering from Moderna who ultimately died, over $1 million. These people don't have insurance for this. Everyone's identified. Everybody says, nope, any injuries, it's on you, for the greater good. Look at the profits that these companies are making. Look at the corruption in the entire science of all of this. So here's a question for you. Should there be anyone responsible? Should any of these people be receive help? Because clearly the mainstream media and the government and the agencies and the firms say no. So they should just suffer and go broke? Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear what you have to say. I'm going to save the longer clip for tomorrow's program. In the interim, while you're calling in, I want to say goodbye to our WBA audience. You're going to hit the news. Everyone else can listen on PRN.fm. This is from the Independent. And this says the following. It says, 1 billion South Asians face water insecurity due to warming in the Himalayas. Warming-induced changes in the Himalayas will impact water availability in the Indus, Gange, and other areas for farming, hydropower, and megacities such as Delhi and Lahore. Quote, New Delhi, nearly a billion people who depend upon the Indus Gange River basins for life and livelihood are threatened by the impact of global warming in the Himalaya Mountains. Melting snow and glaciers will swell the rivers, but changed seasonality will affect farming, other livelihoods, hydropower section, and while causing floods downstream. So they're going to get more water than what they need in some places and cause flooding, destruction, and then they're going to have less water everywhere else. That's the new normal. Heat domes in the West, the new normal. Now go back to what I started sharing 12 years ago and have done 3 documentaries, 3 books on since then, and numerous radio programs. At what point do we as individuals begin to look for the truth in the environment and circumstances we're found in and decide, I'm not in the right place at the right time with the right support system, I better find a better place to live? And what forced a lot of people out of New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco was the loss of jobs because of COVID, the escalating crime and lack of quality of life, and they moved to other states, other places, mainly Florida and Texas, but also out in Utah, Idaho, and Nevada, and in Vermont, and up in Maine. But did they look at the next move based upon, is it sustainable for the future? When you have a hurricane, everything that you've built in your home, your environment, is now as vulnerable as to what degree you're going to get it. It's going to be category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or even a 6. And then it's all gone with no insurance, because that's the backside of all these things. Now insurance companies are stopping insuring people in Florida and in California and other states because they don't want to end up with hundreds of billions of dollars in losses. So now people are living without the insurance. Most. So why aren't we making more informed choices? Why aren't we looking for the truth? Are we in a sustainable environment? I'd like to hear what you had to say. 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Steve. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Excellent show, as always. I'm in Malibu, and the weather here is variable. I just want to augment what you've already said with your documentation. In 2020, March 12, 2020, the Hellenic Society of Forensic Examiners voted not to autopsy any of the purported COVID victims. And again, where is the science there? These are the people who are supposed to tell us what's happening, and they're telling us they're not going to tell us what's happening. Okay, keep up the good work, Gary. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That is one of the problems that we faced early on. I saw that people dying from any condition that was being labeled as COVID. There was even an undercover investigative report where it was recorded where funeral home directors were saying that no matter what the cause of death, car wreck or anything else, suicide, it was listed as COVID. And we saw the same thing in Europe, in Italy, and in Spain, where people in senior citizen homes, retirement homes, assisted living center, and hospice who were at 81 years of age average, which was longer than the normal lifespan, and died from cancer, dementia, heart disease, diabetes, it was all labeled as COVID. Whether they had COVID or not was irrelevant. And the FDA later published in 2020 a report saying that the actual number of people as a percentage who are dying from COVID by itself was about 6%. That means that 97% of the figures we were given were inaccurate. So yes, we have to deconstruct each part of the argument and see where the truth is. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.